Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Once this election's done, people, we're going to start hearing a lot more about the fiscal cliff. And I'll tell you, it ain't going to be pretty.
You know, bottom line, it means less growth, less jobs. So it would be bad for the U.S., but it would be bad for the global economy as well.
Christine Lagarde, the head of the IMF, on where we go from here. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 24th of September. Good as always to have you with us. The head of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde, gave a speech in Washington today in which she said a couple of interesting things. Number one, that the IMF is going to lower its forecast for global economic growth at its annual meetings next month. And number two, paraphrasing only slightly here, she said it's time for policymakers to get their act together and deliver on some of the promises they've made to fix the global economy. And then she went to the IMF radio studios to sit down with us. Madame Lagarde, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Kai.
You spoke today in your speech about the need, the urgent need, in your words, to fix the global economy. Why is this the moment for that speech? Do you sense some danger, perhaps?
Because we have at the moment what we call a momentum. Good things have been done, particularly by the central banks. They've created, you know, a little bit of calm. And responded to the anxiety of the markets. So now is the time for the policymakers to actually also do what they have to do.
Well, what do you make of the fact that it's been the central bank so far doing things and policymakers, by which, of course, we mean politicians, doing, in essence, not a whole lot?
Oh, it's a little bit unfair.
Some
politicians have done quite a bit, but they just have to go further. Now, in the U.S., front, it's a little bit different. Clearly, there is work to be done to avoid the fiscal cliff. There is work to be done to avoid the debt ceiling. And clearly, that is not happening because of the political calendar and the political agenda that is clearly keeping everybody busy doing something else.
As you know, the American Congress never does anything painful until its back is well up against the wall. Can the global economy deal with another 3-4 months of American dithering, for want of a better word?
Well, if it had to, it would suffer. And I think it's a matter that would affect not only the U.S. economy, but also the global economy, given the size of the U.S. You know, everybody has heard about the fiscal cliff. You know, bottom line, it means less growth, less jobs. And the economy of the United States is the largest economy in the world. It has links to the rest of the planet. So it would be bad for the U.S., but it would be bad for the global economy as well.
Do you have confidence that the Americans will figure this out?
I always have trust and confidence in the United States of America. And I very, very much hope that they will live up to the expectations of the people.
Back to the Europeans for a moment. You said I was being a little bit unfair to the policymakers and politicians. But by my count, there have been 21 or 22 summit meetings in Europe over the past 3 or so years to try to get a handle on things. How much more time does the global economy have while the Europeans try to figure things out?
First of all, I think it's a good thing that they meet on a regular basis. They have to make decisions together. They have to argue their respective positions until they come to an agreement. And it's going to be an unending process. It's not just, you know, a magic stick that would just create the union institutions that the Europeans need.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. But you using the phrase, it's an unending process, does not inspire certainty in the global economy. And you spoke today about how damaging uncertainty can be.
It's a union of nations, a union of sovereigns, a union of economies that are aggregating, that are, you know, sort of joining forces in the face of probably the worst possible crisis that we've had since the Great Depression.
Yeah. I wonder, with all respect, if you are putting too much faith in the stake of politicians both here and on the other side of the Atlantic. I mean, honestly.
At the end of the day, you know, politicians represent their constituencies, but they have this broader and higher mandate of representing the country. If the economy of a country goes down, it is not helpful to the country at large. I think they need to see the sort of the global side of things affecting them.
When you have these conversations with your counterparts at other international organizations and international policymakers, secretaries of Treasury and all of that, are they receptive to your remarks or do they say, oh, Christine, come on, you know that's too hard?
I think there is probably part of them that, you know, thinks and maybe not says, oh, Christine, come on, it's just too hard. This is not my agenda. But there is also part of them that understands the logic of what we're saying. When it doesn't go well in Europe, it has an impact on the United States. When it doesn't go well in the United States, it has an impact in the rest of the world. So we are all linked in this.
For those who are listening to this, who are still trying to figure out what exactly happened in the financial crisis and the Great Recession that we've all been through, who do you blame? Do you blame the banks? Do you blame the consumers? Do you blame governments for what happened?
Well, first of all, I don't think the blame game is particularly helpful at the moment. But at the end of the day, when we will, you know, comment history, certainly there will be a blame shared amongst many, many players. The banks, the regulators, the supervisors, the auditors, the lawyers, you just name it. I think the ones that are least to blame are the taxpayers, because very often they've been called upon to resolve the situation. So a lot of blame,
yeah.
Very, very broadly shared, and certainly lessons to learn from that crisis in order not to repeat it. There's still a lot of work to be done, by the way, to fix that.
Well, along those lines, when does this end? How much more work? How many more years?
You know, look, I think there will always be work to do because there is always a temptation to be excessive, to be abusive. And that's precisely the role of regulators and supervisors, to actually try to stop that, prevent it, put in place the legal and regulatory system that is sensible, that is sufficient to protect people from their own mistakes, which is often caused by either greed or fear. Those are the two big drivers in that area.
Christine Lagarde is the managing director at the International Monetary Fund. Madame Lagarde, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Interestingly enough, worries over Europe help weigh down the mood on Wall Street. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, stop me if you've heard this one before. The CEO at Yahoo is about to release a new strategic plan, yet another one that's supposed to jumpstart growth at the slightly less mighty than it used to be internet company. Marissa Mayer came to Yahoo 2 months ago from Google, bearing the burden of finally being the one to offer something different. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
Marissa Mayer made her mark at Google designing its homepage. She focused on making it easy to use. Now she's reportedly keen on improving the look of Yahoo's homepage, but don't expect her to simply mimic her style at Google, so says Kara Swisher at All Things Digital.
It's not going to be like Google. Google is a whole different story of being of simplicity. Yahoo has to pack a lot of information on that page to get people moving places.
Swisher says the new CEO needs to get visitors to click through to Yahoo's wide variety of content. Yahoo has become more of a content provider and less of a search engine. It still makes money selling ads next to search results, but it gets those results from Microsoft search engine Bing. Danny Sullivan, who watches the industry at searchengineland.com, says Yahoo limited its own options years ago.
What they can't do, unfortunately for them, if they wanted to, is go back to having their own search technology, because they would have to try to get back all sorts of employees and recover this technology, and it's a huge task.
The decision to dump its own search technology is just one of the existing strategies Mayer is now left to deal with. Still, at ThinkEquity, analyst Ron Josey says he's hopeful she'll do better than her predecessors.
I do believe Mayer certainly is proven in terms of her knowledge of the web and what consumers are doing there. And so we are a little more optimistic in terms of what they could potentially do, but by no means it's an overnight fix. This is something that likely will be a few years in the making.
Its numbers may have stagnated, but it's not like Yahoo is in dire straits. With 700 million monthly users, it remains one of the web's most popular destinations. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
There was a changing of the guard in the stock market today. Kraft Foods is gone from the Dow Jones Industrial Average. United Healthcare is in its place. And I know we hear about the Dow every day here and elsewhere, but beyond vaguely knowing it's 30 blue chip companies that in theory anyway represent American industry, how much else do we really know? Like, just for instance, how those who's in and who's out of the Dow decisions are really made. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore has this look at who picks the survivors.
The reality show Survivor asks one question.
What does it take to outwit, outplay, and outlast all the others?
That's the same question we could ask of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. 30 big companies make the list, but when they show weakness, they're kicked off the island.
AIG, Citigroup got pulled out during the financial crisis. General Motors, when it was facing bankruptcy.
That's Sam Matera, a vice president with stock research website Benzinga. Kraft replaced the imploding AIG in 2008. Now Kraft is splitting into two companies and has been bumped by United Healthcare.
Healthcare insurance is a big concern and a big issue for a lot of Americans. So if this index is supposed to tell us what's going on in the stock market, the economy, it ought to include healthcare.
David Blitzer is the chairman of the index committee at the S&P Dow Jones Indices. He's kind of like the head of the tribal council for the Dow. Companies, lobby him all the time.
We do get phone calls. We get people want to make absolutely sure we know all the good things about their company.
Blitzer and his team keep a secret list of potential candidates for the Dow. And just as reality villains can turn into heroes, so can companies. Take AIG, which just made a profit for the government. The folks at the S&P Dow Jones Index joked about taking it back.
Yes, there is redemption in the financial sphere. We kidded each other about taking AIG, but we decided it was a little too soon.
The companies that join the Dow must have roughly the same stock price as the ones they replace. That's why some competitors, like Apple, aren't even allowed on the island. No Dow stock comes close to $700 a share. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
Coming up, listen closely, everybody, because there's going to be a test.
I like to relax as long as it doesn't interfere with work, or it's usually better to try to change your own behavior than to try to change others.
There's no right answer, but it is your career on the line. First, though, let's do the numbers. Yeah, well, so the markets began the week down. The Dow Industrial's off 20 points, a tenth of 1%, 13,558. The NASDAQ fell 19 points, 6/10%, 3160. The S&P 500 off 3 points, 2/10%, ended at 1456. Tech stocks told the tale of new and old lovers. Apple lost more than 1% of its shine after not selling as many iPhone 5s this weekend as analysts had expected. Maybe because Apple pretty much ran out of them after 5 million or so. Investors feeling for Facebook lost 9% as doubts persist about its ability to make money off of you and me. They embrace that old flame, Google, whose ad revenue maybe isn't glamorous, but it's always there for you. Google up 2%, passing its record high set 5 years ago. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. We'll find out how the summer went for cruise ship operators. Carnival Corporation releases their quarterly earnings. President Obama will address the United Nations General Assembly. He's expected to talk about Iran's nuclear program and other national security concerns. And on this day in 1690, the first newspaper in America was published. The full title of that paper? Public Occurrences, Both Foreign and Domestic. I'm Bridget Bodner.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The Village Voice and some other big names in the world of alternative weekly newspapers wants out of the sex ad business. A deal announced today is going to separate The Voice from a company called Backpage.com. The site that's full of adult classified ads has been accused of facilitating prostitution and child trafficking, and as a result has drawn enormous controversy and legal attention, as well as some tidy profits to The Voice. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has more now on the economics of alt weeklies.
Ads from businesses that either wouldn't or couldn't advertise in mainstream papers have always enriched the alternative press. Businesses like nightclubs, holistic medicine, and organic grocers just feel more at home in alternative media. Most mainstream dailies don't accept adult classifieds, so they've flourished in alt-weeklies. Sex ads may not have been vital to the Voice papers, but they mattered.
They would not have fought the controversy about their ads so hard if it had not been a big part of their revenue model.
That's Andrew Bojan. He's former managing editor of D.C.'s alt-weekly, Washington City Paper, now at the Poynter Institute. The Voice declined our interview requests. Other papers have already shut down their sex classifieds. Tiffany Shackelford runs the trade group, Association of Alternative News Media.
Most of the publishers just understood that if that was a turnoff to or a distraction to some of the other advertisers, that perhaps it wasn't worth it.
She says those ads represented a small percentage of overall profits, and many papers never took them. With or without, the alternative press faces all the challenges menacing the rest of the media. But some alt-weeklies are doing just fine.
Our circulation has been increasing.
That's Fran Zankowski, CEO of the Colorado Springs Independent, speaking words rarely heard from mainstream publishers. He says being alternative is part of why the paper thrives.
We believe in local. Local ownership, local publishers make a big difference in the success of a paper. I think I've said local about 10 times now.
And that means more ads from local business, something everyone from Google on down covets. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
This year's drought has pushed food prices higher and, as a result, quite possibly changed how you eat. Turns out the drought's affecting how beef and dairy cows are eating, too. Usually they get a diet of corn feed. But with corn prices at record highs this past summer, a lot of farmers are looking for a sweeter deal. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner has kind of an amazing story.
Kansas dairy farmer Orville Miller says corn's just too expensive right now to give his cows an all-corn-fed diet, so he's replacing about 5% of it with chocolate.
Oh, cows love chocolate. When I feed the cows, they go nosing through their total mix ration trying to find pieces of chocolate, and they'll eat those out first.
Miller also feeds his cows taco shell rejects. Kai Fanning at Great Plains Livestock Consulting in Nebraska says others are substituting
cereal, French fries, ice cream.
Not to mention marshmallows, cookies, and gummy worms.
Cattle can utilize gummy worms just the same way we can. They put on a lot of weight with those products because they're high in sugar.
So where does all this cheap, starchy sugar come from? Brand Dill works for a company that sells candy salvage to farmers and ranchers.
Companies that produce the chocolate, basically they were just getting rid of it out of the warehouses and whatnot off the pallets that had been broken and spoiled.
Dill says prices for broken chocolate have more than doubled because of the demand, but it's still cheaper than corn. For now, some farmers are sticking with more traditional substitutes like damaged potatoes, which cows find rather bland. So farmers add molasses, says Wisconsin dairy agent Nolan Anderson.
It's kind of like adding a little sugar on top of that cereal, and you can get them to eat almost anything that way.
Just like five-year-olds. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
There's been a through line in this election campaign and in the economy, really, for the past year or so, about income inequality, the 1%, the 99%, the 47% as well. But if you drive 3 hours or so north of New York City, outside Albany, you'll find the place the U.S. Census Bureau says is the most equal place in the country. We sent Tracy Samuelson to see what that looks like.
I'm Mrs. Dickman. I'm Melissa.
In 1967, Joanne and Fred Dickman moved to a traditional white colonial in Country Knolls.
It had a lot of couples with young children, just the ages that we were, about the same places in our life, career-wise and so forth. And that's the kind of neighborhood that we wanted.
They bought the house with a handshake and a refundable $100 deposit from a developer named Robert Van Patten. And if there's one person responsible for all the equality today in Country Knolls, it's him. Back when he began developing this neighborhood in 1964, he built homes that were all the same five models, three long, low ranches and two colonials.
We are clearly in the burbs.
Stephen Schmidt is a professor of economics at nearby Union College, a small liberal arts school. He's also my navigator as we drive through the winding wooded streets of Country Knolls.
You notice a certain sameness about the housing stock? That creates a certain sameness of the people who move into them. They have enough money to afford these houses, but not enough money to go to something snazzier.
The median household income in Country Knolls is $107,000 a year. Not one family here lives below the poverty line, but for the most part, the super rich don't live here either. So, who does live here?
You like dogs? Okay. Lainey, wait. Sit. Come on in.
Dawn Coletta and her family moved to Country Knolls in early 2011, to a colonial that's twice the size of their old house on Long Island. When I asked to interview her for this story, she did a little Googling before we spoke.
Well, I told my husband the income that I saw, it was like $107,000. We're under that. So he goes, well, I guess we're under average, you know, so.
This fall, Coletta started driving a public school bus, which will bump her family's income to match that of her neighbors. Her husband makes $90,000 a year as a repairman for Verizon. Her neighbor also worked for Verizon and is now retired.
And it's just funny. I go, oh, we really are like Stepford wives. Yeah. Everybody's the same.
Coletta says that as a joke, but Country Knolls residents have some pretty striking similarities that go beyond just income. About 95% are white, 77% are married, nearly 98% own their own homes. Those stats might strike you as unusual, but folks here don't really see it that way.
So you keep joking about that. Do you feel like everyone's kind of the same, or?
No. There's older couple across the street, then there's people with little ones. So it's all different, but it's just funny how our backgrounds are all, you know, the same.
I asked pretty much everyone I met in Country Knolls if they think they missed out on anything by living and raising children in a place with so much sameness. And they all said basically, no, they wouldn't trade the good schools or the character of the neighborhood. There's space to breathe here. In Country Knolls, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Most of the time when you apply for a job, you're trying to find one that you think looks right for you. You send along your resume, you have a chat with a would-be boss, and either you get the job or you don't. That equation is being flipped on its head, though, by some big companies. Xerox, for one, but there are others. They're using big data to tell you what kind of job you'd be good at. Sounded interesting to us, so we called up Michael Hausman. He's with Evolve. It's a company up in San Francisco that does hiring data analysis for call center workers specifically. And we asked him to give me the kind of aptitude test he gives when he's consulting for those companies to see where I might fit in if this radio thing doesn't quite work out. So, Mike, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So hit me with it. We're going to have a little session here, you and I?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So we're going to be evaluating you for a couple positions.
Okay.
You give me your honest response, and then at the end, I'll tell you which position you're best suited for.
Okay.
I'm going to give you two statements, and you tell me which is most appropriate for you.
Okie doke.
All right. So number one, I like to relax as long as it doesn't interfere with work, or it's usually better to try to change your own behavior than to try to change others.
Oh, it's usually better to change my own behavior, yeah.
Okay, great. Excellent. Let's go with question number two. People often underestimate the hardships others have faced in their lives, or I prefer to jump right into a task rather than spend time planning out the details.
That's pretty funny. You've been talking to my friends. No, number two, I prefer to jump right in.
Okay, great. All right, here we go. Question number three. It takes a lot to really upset me, or it's usually best not to express your emotions at work.
Oh, man. This is hard. Can both of those be true? I have to pick one?
You got to pick one, yeah.
It takes a lot to upset me.
Mm. Okay.
Okay.
Great. And then finally, here's the last question. You gave a successful presentation to five colleagues from another department.
Yeah.
The next day, you realized some of the information you presented was incorrect and could negatively impact that department's credibility.
Yeah.
Of the following, which is most similar to how you would handle this situation? A, correct the information in the slide deck and email it to the group, letting them know some important updates have been made. B, ask my manager how she would like me to proceed. C, ask a well-respected colleague that I'm close to what I should do. Or D, briefly meet with each of the attendees to explain the error in person.
Oh, no, you got to fess up right away. So whatever the most transparent choice is, A, I guess, right?
Okay, yeah. Let's see here.
As you add this up, I'm almost not feeling good about myself about these choices.
Not at all. Again, this isn't a reflection of you as a person. Right. It's just your fit for a certain type of role.
All right.
So based on the responses, and again, this is a very shortened assessment, the role you're best suited for is trainer for frontline hourly workers. In general, okay. we find that people who answered the way that you did are somewhat easygoing and like to avoid conflict and fairly personable, easy to work with.
Well, which is interesting because I would say that's generally true, but how far can you apply these algorithms and this data, right? I mean, does it work for, I don't know, radio hosts and stuff like that?
Well, you know, there are assessments that have been administered in pretty much every vertical, and you find that the numbers don't lie. These are actually very predictive of, you know, someone's performance in a role. I'll check our archives to see if we have radio host, and then I'll try to tee that one up.
Let me know.
Yeah.
Where, though, is, and this is going to make me sound, I don't know, old media or something, where is the role of the hiring manager, the person in this process, right?
Yeah, so, you know, this isn't meant to replace that person. There is a role for recruiters, and the fact of the matter is there's also a certain level of human judgment that when you sit down with someone and interview them, you can't really replace that. But, you know, what we found, and this kind of harkens to Moneyball, is that, you know, when you look at data is actually a very strong way to give accurate predictions about how well someone's likely to do on a job and how long they're likely to stay.
One more thing, actually, before I let you go.
Sure.
You sure those questions don't reflect on me as a person?
All right. Absolutely not. Again, purely job relevant skills.
Fair enough. Dr. Michael Hausman is the managing director of analytics for a company called Evolve. It's up in San Francisco. Mike, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, which I offer against my own self-interest because I like my office to be cooler than most, but a study out from Cornell University that I saw this morning in Fast Company magazine says that when office temperatures are low, 68 degrees specifically, people committed 44% more mistakes and were half as productive as they were when the thermostat was set at 77. To which my uncharitable reply is, sweaters, right? Put on a sweater? No? All right. We're done. Today, the Dow off 20 points, 0.1%. The NASDAQ fell 19.6%. The S&P 500 shed 3.2%. Our producers include Gina Delvac, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Megan Larson, Liza Madry, Joel Patterson, Jolie Badokas, and David Weinberg. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.